6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. This is your host, John Quinlan. Coming up in the next hour, we have a great discussion about a whole variety of subjects that listeners to this show love to engage in. Essentially, we're going to be talking about fixing the broken system, whether it comes to the subject of democracy, whether it comes to the subject of media and other things that are fundamental to the effective functioning of a democratic way of life. The author we're going to be speaking with for the next hour is James Gustav Speth. He's the author of a trilogy of books, most recently America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. And this will be a chance for us to engage in conversation again about some of the topics I think that really drive the folks who listen to this program, the folks who were involved with the Wisconsin Uprising, anyone who is politically active. Has a vision of a way that things could be different, the transformative possibilities that exist out there, all the interconnections between different issues. So again, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with James Gustav Speth, author of America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. A little bit of business to get out of the way before we get into that. First of all, want to issue a big thank you to our current engineer, Lucas, who is going to be going on a leave for the winter, but we sure have appreciated all of his great efforts on behalf since I've been back on the air. So, Lucas, Godspeed. Have a good winter. And we'll be taking his place for at least a part of the winter is Dace, who's a returning volunteer. One other loose end from last week, as many of you remember, we had a special panel. It was folks who had recently been let off from WTDY because of the changes that are happening with their format. We were very pleased to have their input about how this impacts on the future of radio. Tom Walker, who is the president of Midwest Family Broadcasting, where they are, had a chance to listen to the show and wanted to we appreciate his kind words in terms of saying that he thought that there were some very valuable points made during that hour. But one of the things that he wanted to clarify, we talked about in other cities, especially where Clear Channel or outside companies play a part, that sometimes during times of crisis there have been situations where there's been no one local on the ground to get people through a tornado or a chemical spill or other things. And he made the justifiable point that should that happen, they are very well set up to provide 24/7 coverage. So just want to acknowledge that point and, again, thank him for his kind words. And then one other thing we wanted to give notice to is an event that's happening later in the week, one of our favorite guests and providers of guests is on the line with us. Barb Olson is here from the Madison Roffa Sister City Project. Barb, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Well, my voice is a little funny. I'm recovering from a cold, but
You know, we got a lot of that. Right? I think about half the station is heading out as we speak. So luckily, knock on wood, I'm okay so far. But we'll try to carry this along here. So you later in the week, Iyad Bernat is someone who's coming to town, a well-known Palestinian activist for peace. Is that correct?
Yeah, he is. He's a young 30, 40 something farmer. He has a family and four children, and he comes from a village which is very well known called the Baleen, which is one of the villages that's being heavily impacted by Israel's taking of land, both for settlements and for the building of what they call the separation or the apartheid wall. And apparently about 60% of the land around Baleen has already been annexed, and this process got started actually in 1991, when the first land was taken. So on that basis alone, you can tell that it's really not having too much to do with security. It has with the seizure of land for settlements. Baleen got the confiscation of land escalated very rapidly around 2005, and Baleen, among other villages, got together and formed what they call popular committees, and they started to campaign against the wall. And so every day for a while, and then every week since 2006, they have organized a non-violent civil demonstration in opposition to the wall. several people have been killed. Many have been injured in the response of the Israeli army. And so he is on his first visit to the U.S. He's on a national speaking tour. It's about a four-month tour. It's a very long tour. Covers 50 or 60 cities. And he's basically coming to talk about what's going on there. He will be here in Madison on Sunday, next Sunday, the 16th at 2 p.m., and he'll be speaking at Memorial United Church of Christ, which is at 5705 Lacey Road in Fitchburg. And he has a lot of pictures. He also has some footage, including some footage from a film called Five Broken Cameras, which was made by his brother, Imad Bernat, and which is premiered, I believe, at Sundance and is becoming a little bit more known. It's a spectacular film having to do with the five cameras that his brother purchased, starting with the first one to take pictures of his young children, and then each one was subsequently broken in the process of the demonstrations. And so he and an Israeli filmmaker named Guy Davidi put that into a film. Iyad will not be showing the film, but he will have some footage and some excerpts from that. So we're hoping that people will come out and find out what's going on there. There's been a lot of news lately about Gaza and a lot of news about what happened at the UN, but there really isn't much news about what goes on a daily basis in the West Bank.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like a really valuable performance. I've got sort of, I guess, the opposite of an announcement. I don't know if this is helpful or not, but originally you planned a dinner that weekend that I know because of the rush of holidays and everything. You called off. Is that right?
Yeah, we just decided not to do it. We were going to be raising emergency aid for actually for Gaza relief.
Yeah.
So if people are interested in that, we are doing a campaign for the month of December to raise emergency relief that's going to go through the Middle East Children's Alliance.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in that, you can go to our website to get more information, and I'll give you that in a minute. Or you can go online and go to the Middle East Children's Alliance, and they have a donation process there that you can just follow, because they've actually got some people, I believe, on the ground this week, and they're starting to organize some different types of aid depending on what they need, you know, there, because there was quite a lot of destruction. And I think what they're mainly focusing on is some psychological work with children and families, as well as more traditional types of relief. So that was going to be the dinner, but we just felt it was too close to the holidays to put it together. So no, we aren't going to be doing that.
I wouldn't have mentioned it, but I know you were polling folks, so just in case somebody heard about it but didn't hear about the change in plans. So
right, yeah, no, there won't be. We'll
okay.
We'll be returning to the dinner in the spring. Probably.
Yeah, I was going to say not that you don't have enough. You're a lot occupying your plate right now, so that's good. Well, if you could, we're going to need to close out, but if you could just one more time mention the times and dates of Iyad Barnat's appearance here in the community and a place where people can find out more information.
Yeah, it'll be next Sunday, a week from yesterday, December 16th. It starts at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and it'll be at the Memorial United Church of Christ, which is at 5705 Lacey Road out in Fitchburg. It's south of Madison. If people need more information, they can go to our website, which is www.madisonrafah, that's R-A-F-A-H, and it's all one word, .org. And you can contact us at Rafa Sister City, that's all one word, at yahoo.com. Or if you need to use the phone, you can call Memorial United Church of Christ, and their number is 273-1008.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's where Phil Hasslinger, senior pastor, right?
Yes, Phil was very excited about bringing the here, and so they were the first of a long list of co-sponsors. So.
Yeah, Phil, many folks know, is a longtime Capital Times editor who went back to seminary and has been a minister there for several years now, and somebody who's been a really good voice in terms of trying to get a good view of what's happening there. So hey, Barb, thanks so much for coming on, and your voice managed to survive, so we're glad about that. And again, we encourage people to come out to these events next weekend. Have a good day.
Yep, thanks, John.
All right, take care. And once again, for those of you just joining us, this is A Public Affair here on WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Our guest for the next hour is James Gustav Speth. He's the author of America the Possible, Manifesto for Near Economy, a New Economy, rather, and a distinguished career spanning more than four decades. He's helped to build two of America's leading environmental groups. He served as a White House advisor to President Jimmy Carter, led the largest United Nations program for international development, and served as dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He's now professor of law at the Vermont Law School, senior fellow at Demos and the United Nations Foundation. He's the author of Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, and The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. He has let me know that that Gus is actually his preferred name. And Gus, hey, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi, John. Very nice to be on your show.
Very nice to be on here. And actually, in the interest of disclosure here, I guess you've got a tie with the United Nations Foundation. I'm the Wisconsin Division President here in Wisconsin of the United Nations Association, which is a group who's recently fused into that group. So I'll be especially interested in hearing about some of the international implications of what you have to say. But I wanted to start off at a basic place. It's something. It's a scene that you paint very vividly in your introduction, and I think it kind of epitomizes a lot of what we'll be talking about today. These are really difficult subjects, really difficult challenges in terms of the system that's broken right now. And if we don't take action, certainly things are not looking good for us. But by the same token. You extracted, I think, from a beautiful scene over there in Vermont of migratory birds taking off. And I think you talked about it both as kind of evidence of nature's grandeur, but you also identified that human beings had something to do with the possibility that scene could happen. Could you tell that story to our listeners?
Well, I don't think it's a story that... I think many of your listeners will have experienced this story. There are places where migratory fowl gather in vast numbers. I was recently out at a wildlife refuge in New Mexico, and the cranes were there, and they were having the festival of the cranes. And this the one I talk about in the book was one of the spots that the migrating snow geese. Return to every year here in Vermont, and you know, and I think we take such joy in these moments, we really have to remember it every time that we do that this is thank you government for this, not just thank the Lord or thank Mother Nature, but thank you, government, because these are very special places that communities and governments at the various levels in our country have come together to create and to protect and to nurture the spots so that they are wonderful feeding and resting grounds for the migratory fowl. And I think that's one of the points of the book, really. We have so maligned and attacked and vilified and outsourced and shrunk key aspects of our government, particularly at the national level, that it really isn't the government that we need right now to meet the great challenges that our country faces. And at the international level, we've concentrated so heavily on international governance institutions that deal with economic and security affairs, to the tragic neglect of global environmental and social conditions. You mentioned your UN connection. I was the head of the UN Development Program for half a dozen years in the 1990s, and our country, frankly, performed very badly in providing ongoing support to the UN in general and specifically to international humanitarian and anti-poverty and environmental efforts around the world. It's not a pretty scene.
Well, just to take off on that, we often, I think, as Americans, often the truism that's out there is that, we are one of the most generous countries in the world. We are ahead of the game in terms of human rights, in terms of poverty eradication, all kinds of other things. And just elaborating what you're saying just now, one of the first points you make in the book is it just isn't so. So much of our resources go into being the world's police people that among other reasons, that for a lot of reasons, so much of this has been neglected, and we're quite a ways down the list. Is that right?
Well, someone said that we should think about federal government as an insurance company with an army.
Uh-huh.
If you add up all the security spending, which is over two-thirds of the discretionary budget, and put in the social insurance programs, you've pretty much you've accounted for most of the government. So we're now spending $1 trillion a year on military and intelligence and security affairs. It's just a huge enterprise that many would expand even further, even though we are already spending almost half of the world's military expenditure in one country, 43%. And in addition to, we spend more than the next 15 or so countries combined on the military. And this is part of the severe imbalance in our international posture. The other side of the coin is that we are the worst. I looked at a 20-country sample of the basically our peer countries, the advanced democracies. And in that sample, we are the worst in joining international treaties. We have this severe exceptionalism, manifest most recently in the Senate's refusal to join the treaty that is going to provide certain opportunities and rights for the disabled.
So frustrating and so unnecessary, yeah.
But we don't belong to the Convention on the Rights of the Child or the Landmine Convention or the Criminal Court Convention or almost all of the international conventions dealing with the global environment. We just don't participate as a real And even when we show up for the meetings, as we are doing as we speak in Doha for the climate meeting, the annual Gabfest on climate, we basically are a problem for people who want to get things done rather than an asset. So we have this severe imbalance, and you mentioned the funding. For decades, we were the least generous country in the OECD. In terms of our development and humanitarian assistance. Recently, I think Italy and Japan, I think it is, have fallen a tad below us as a percentage of GDP that we contribute to international development assistance in the largest sense. And this is far from being the most generous. We are the chintziest. And we spend, all of the available resources and then some on our military. And as Nicholas Kristof wrote in the New York Times not long ago, when you have an armful of hammers, every problem looks like a nail. And when you have an armful of weapons, every problem looks like something you need to use those weapons on. We have tended to into military solutions to problems that we should be able to solve otherwise.
All right. James, we're having a little bit of fade in and out. I think everybody's hearing everything, but if you could just be especially conscious of just speaking directly into the receiver, I think it may be another technical problem. And Lucas, if we continue to have that, we may want to reestablish the connection, but we'll see how that goes. Again, I think everybody's heard everything you've said so far, though, without any problem. Fundamentally, your book is, you make arguments in multiple realms in terms of change that needs to happen, again, in terms of the way democracy itself functions, the way that media address their role in terms of informing the public. But you also, I think, are an advocate for a different way of framing the way that we view the economy. So much of our economy is driven by the quest for more and more. And it just seems like that is such a basic contradiction in a world where the individual American citizen's footprint is so much bigger than, say, their contemporaries in some of those countries you mentioned in Europe and Asia and other places. You know, we obviously are going to eventually reach a place where we can't keep on striving for more. So in the absence of that driving the economy, that you know, as you know, President Bush's admonition, you know, post 9/11, that the way to address that problem was to go out and spend. You know, what kind of an ethos or what kind of motivations do we need to start applying in terms of the economic picture?
Well, let's talk about both pieces of that. I think the first piece is you know, is this sort of growth fetish that we have, by which I mean a GDP fetish. You know, it's a sort of incantation that if we could revive the economy and get growth moving again, somehow our problems will be solved. And the fact is that we've had tremendous growth in the United States since, say, 1980. During that time, the size of the U.S. economy more than doubled. Maybe it's 125% larger than today than it was in 1980. And the GDP today is higher than it was before the Great Recession in 2008. And what has happened during that period in which we had, you know, tremendous growth in the economy, doubling? You know, we had inequality return to 1920s levels. We had poverty go to an all-time high. Real wage rates flatlined during that whole period. We pushed the climate issue to the point where we are on the cusp of ruining the planet. Life satisfaction flatlined during that period of growth. Depression went up. Levels of trust in the country went down. Basically, you know, we lost 42,000 manufacturing plants. And as I said, today the GDP is back up to higher than it was before the recession, and we still have 15% of the people, 15% of the labor force, either unable to find work or unable to find full-time work that they want, or having dropped out of the labor force for lack of opportunity. So this is, you know, growth doesn't deliver. And just take the jobs issue. To put, create the jobs that America needs now, just to take care of new entrants into the labor force in the U.S., you know, if you're just relying on GDP growth to put people back to work, you have to grow over 2.5% a year just to take care of new entrants into the labor force. And you have to grow a lot faster than that, maybe twice as fast as that, to really, you know, bring the unemployment rate down sharply, which is what we ought to be doing. So basically, I think this, you know, growth is kind of a snare and a delusion. It doesn't deliver. It detracts us from doing the public policy things that we do urgently need to do to grow the things that truly do need to grow, like job opportunities. You know, growth, just this incantation and focus on GDP growth is, you know, we should be focusing on the things that really do need to grow and making and formulating public policies and spending policies and tax policies that further those things. And of course, you know, when you say that growth is your highest priority, it just puts a damper on a lot of things that we really do need to do that could actually slow growth, but would improve quality of life, and you know, and it empowers the folks who have the technology and the money, which are the banks and the corporations. It empowers them. Because your priority above all else is economic growth, and you have to give the folks who can do the growing, or should be doing the growing, what they need, and so we have this serious problem. I think I talk in the book America the Possible about the limits to growth and the limits of growth. The limits of growth are what I've been describing. They are things that growth, aggregate GDP growth, are just not delivering for us, and not delivering better lives in the largest sense now, and deflecting us from doing the things that we do need to do to create the jobs that we need. The limits to growth are all about the headwinds that are standing in the way of the kinds of growth that we've had in certain decades in the past in the country. If we're going to do the right thing about climate change, it may cost us some growth. We're prioritizing growth above all else, and energy consumption needed for that growth above all else, then it's doing the kinds of rapid declines in greenhouse gas emissions that we need between now and 2050 are going to be made all that more difficult. You look at an index of commodity prices, including particularly energy prices, and in the last couple of decades, we've seen the stark reversal in what had been a century almost of declining commodity prices. And now that whole decline has now been virtually wiped out by increases in the prices of resources and energy, and that's driven by scarcities. We are running out of planet. And so I think there are, and the climate issue is just one issue where this endless growth is going syndrome that we have is going to run into problems.
And I want to come back to climate change in just a moment, because I think you make such a good case too that isn't something we can necessarily wait on and to have a slow approach to it. It's something that could. And maybe already has reversed very dramatically in a short period of time. All of this, there's an urgency about it. For those of you just joining in and midstream here, again, we're speaking with Gus, otherwise known as James Gustav Speth. He's the author of America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. And Gus is someone who's had a distinguished career, including serving as an advisor in the Carter and Clinton administrations, also worked with the United Nations and their development programs, senior fellow at Demos, professor of law at Vermont Law School. He's also someone who's engaged in disobedience in the past year in front of the White House and been arrested for that. So someone who's worked for both inside and outside the system. Another theme I want to come back to in just a second. Before I do that, though, I think, the foundation of a lot of what you're talking about here, you talk about very early in the book, that there was this opportunity in the wake of the New Deal, FDR's Four Freedoms and his Second Bill of Rights, the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we had this chance of looking at things differently. But as you say, instead, we unleashed a virulent, fast-growing strain of corporate consumerist capitalism. What you're talking about throughout the book may not necessarily fit into the category of the radical. A lot of it is very commonsensical. But a lot of it does involve Americans making a commitment to transformative change. We missed that opportunity back in the 30s. We probably missed it post 9/11 when there were all kinds of new paradigms, new ways we could have looked at things. And yet, I think you possess some level of optimism that perhaps we could make those changes now. What's driven by that?
Well, as the author D. Hock said, things are much too bad for pessimism. In the book, I begin by looking at this vast array of problems that we have. I mentioned this 20-country sample, our peer countries, and I looked at 30 different indicators of well-being and international citizenship and well-being in our country, and we're not just performing poorly in that sample, in those indicators. We're performing worst. We're number one in exactly the place we don't want to be, at the bottom of the heap, on social conditions, on environmental performance, on our democracy performance, and in various economic performing categories. So, you know, my conclusion is that when you have problems across this huge front of issues, and I do describe them, you have to conclude that it's not due to small reasons. We have encompassing problems because we live and work in a system of political economy that is hardwired, is programmed to give us certain, you know, to do certain things, to prioritize certain things. But it, and I could go into that if you want to, but it's not prioritized to sustain and restore people and place and planet.
Sure.
And that's the fundamental problem. So if you are, you know, if we're serious about wanting to build a better world for our children and grandchildren, we're going to have to change the system. So system change becomes, you know, the key thing. And the book is really all about how system change can come to America.
So if you can hold on that thought, we will spend most of the rest of the program, I think, on talking about some of those solutions and other things. In the meantime, we do have a caller on the line. Caller, your comment or question, please.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
I'm okay. So maybe we're at a turning point in the conversation. That's what I was hoping to get to.
Okay.
I would encourage the guest to use the rest of the remaining time on this program to basically kind of, you know, focus on the creative strategies we need to be doing at all levels, whether that's at a school board level or at a national level or at an international level, because the United States is not the only country in this kind of in a crisis. There's many places in the, around the world that have lots of big things going on that are impacting the globe, including, like, for example, in China. I just wanted to encourage you to move away from, you know, kind of like the high quality gripe session, which we have enough of.
All right.
On the left. I think we all know what the problems are.
Point well taken.
Solutions that we need to really throw out there and get the conversation going around.
Caller,
just leave it to you to take the lead on that.
Before you go, just to ask you, do you have a sense of optimism, a sense of hope that we could turn things around? We have. Yep, I guess we lost you there. Okay. Gus, your thoughts. I think he's getting at a good point. And, you know, to give your book credit, I think you both take adequate time to lay out the challenges, but also there's some great things that we'll be going to in a moment. I think our solutions. But is that part of our problem sometimes, that we focus in on kind of the over?
I'm not sure I agree with the caller.
Okay, please go ahead.
In this sense.
Yeah.
I think perhaps your listeners and the gentleman who called in are aware of the sort of the depth and the number of the challenges that we have in the country. But I think that most people aren't. I think when you point out that most, you know, that only 30 critical indicators, we're at the bottom of the advanced countries, the very bottom. It's a surprise to most people, and I've spoken about these issues now for some time. I think our media does a perfectly terrible job of really giving the full sense in our of how bad things have become in the country, and I think our politicians are very, very reluctant to say, you know, we had in this campaign for president both candidates repeating the, you know, stories about America's greatness and the fact that, you know, we're the best and things of that type. And it's just, it's not the case anymore.
And
we'll only do the right things about and see a vision of the need for deep systemic transformation in the country if we appreciate how severely wrong things are now and are continuing to worsen. So I think that's, you know, I just would make that point. But, you know, obviously the bulk of the book, and I'm delighted to talk about some of the transformative changes that we need.
Oh, and it seems like the theme of your book is, when you talk about American exceptionalism, it's one of many things you want to transform into something different. American exceptionalism can also be defined as our ability to recognize our problems and to take action and to achieve societal change. You know,
I think Madison is a good place for that.
All right.
I was in Madison not long ago, and And I think there's still reverberations and vibrations from the Madison Uprising. I had the feeling that the progressive communities in Madison were about ready to go again if something would give them a moment or something to set it off again. It was quite a thing that the city and the community and the area did for the country during that time, and made us all very proud.
No, I sure appreciate that. I think there are ripples that are still being felt here and, of course, across the country to what happened in 2011 and 2012 here. Actually, speaking of that activist Madison community, apparently some of them are on the phone and wanting to join into this. And we'll be sure, though, in our remaining time, also to give you a chance to talk a bit more detail about some of the recommendations that you have for change. But first, caller, your comment or question, please.
Yeah, hi, John.
Yes.
Yeah, first of all, I would like to say that you're absolutely correct in your statement that FDR and his administration represented probably one of the last manifestations of progressive thought in this country. And it is also the last, it was probably the last chance that we had to have a social security system that would include national health care. That was seriously considered at the time, but not surprisingly, the AMA and others launched an extensive lobbying campaign against it using all the same arguments they do today about it being socialist and taking away the patient's freedoms of choice. So we have that lost opportunity. And then the question about change, I have become very cynical and think that there will be no real change environmentally or otherwise until and unless we can replace the present economic system, economic order that we have in this country. And it's also my concern that if we were to replace the political system in our country with one, say, of Germany, which is hardly an example of a Marxist state, but if we were to want to replace our political system with that of Germany, the social welfare, the parliamentary system, et cetera, that would literally, I think, take blood. A lot of people would have to would die and would have to be killed in order to be able to replace our social system. So that's my very pessimistic point of view, and I'd be interested in hearing any input that your guest might have on my not very happy scenario.
Okay.
Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks for the call. Gus, maybe this is a good place to focus in on, I think, some of the solutions you have in terms of democracy, whether it's universal suffrage, different ways of voting, as the caller mentioned, parliamentary system. What do you think some of the solutions are there?
Well, you know, there are two big things we can do now in the country and must do now. One of them is to bring the future into the present in our communities. And that's the great thing happening across America today, is all the community revitalization efforts, the transition towns, the sustainable communities, the new food system, the new types of enterprises, the co-op movement, the public banking movement, and on and on. And I think that's, you know, that door is open. The other door that I think we need to open is to beat back this creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy in our country with a series of very deep pro-democracy political reforms before we really lose it. And, you know, those reforms are something that a broad spectrum of Americans, in my judgment, you know, ought to get behind in the wake of this election. You know, we need to secure the voter. We, you know, the voting is in most industrial countries, being registered to vote is the default position when you get to voting age. You're registered. We need to have a real reform in the administration of our elections, with paper trails and secure systems and open the vote up for longer periods of time, and things that people tried to roll back in this past election. We need independently set congressional districts. We need constitutional amendments to undo this line of Citizens United cases and to do away with the Electoral College. We need a lot of reforms in the in the lobbying process. We have to remember that corporations spend maybe 10 times what they do own influence peddling and lobbying after the elections than they do during the elections. And so we need a process of doing in the revolving door, of making lobbying expenditures of types that aren't now covered transparent, and creating a system of small donor and public financing for elections like some of our states have. And doing in, outlawing this process of lobbyists being able to bundle financial contributions. Connecticut has done that.
Gus, I apologize. I need to interrupt because we do have several callers on the line, but that's a great menu of choices. And again,
it keeps going, too.
Yeah, and we refer people back to the book because you're exactly right. You've got some great suggestions that go into great detail. Caller, your comments or question for Gus?
Yes, we may look back on 2011, 12, and 13 as the beginning of tremendous, huge changes, but the question is, will they be for improvements or disasters? 3 weeks from now, the fiscal cliff will be crossed unless the federal politicians come to some compromise. And I understand that if that happens, that one half of the budget cuts will come out of the Pentagon budget, and one half of the budget cuts will come out of the civilian federal budget, and that every taxpayer, every income taxpayer, will pay higher rates going back to the rates that existed under under Bill Clinton. And it's possible that could cause, could lead to other great changes that would be improvements for us, such as having non-edible renewable energy, the current trend toward growing crops and converting corn and soybeans into fuels for vehicles has got to stop. It seems like it's a crime against humanity to let people starve while we're fueling our SUVs. The drought this year and last year down in Texas is going to cause shifting in the agricultural and food production systems. There will be a lot less beef, probably less pork also, and there will be more of us humans eating the grains that are grown directly and being much more efficient in our use of the land.
And caller, if you could, let me just ask Gus about that. We apologize. We have several other callers on the line, but thank you. Good points. One of the things that I think the caller is evoking, too, that's a theme of your book, is how things like feeding the world and climate change, all of these decisions, all these crux points we're at right now are all interrelated. You make an example. You also talk about how, in the case of climate change, things could happen very dramatically, especially as things develop in the Arctic and methane gas comes up and all kinds of other things that could change ocean currents. Anyway, there's an urgency for us to address the agricultural crisis, but that's not lacking in connections to these other issues we need to address as well. Is that right?
Well, I think we have multiple problems. And they are connected. And I think the point I would make about the climate issue is it's the clearest example of why we have to walk on two legs. We need to pursue this agenda of transformative change. If we don't, change the system, then we'll never really solve all these problems. On the other hand, we have some emergencies in front of us right now, dealing with the jobs crisis, dealing with the problem of global climate change, which is enormously serious. I mean, we're already seeing huge effects from global climate change, and we've only experienced about 1 degree Fahrenheit global average warming. That number is slated to go up sixfold or more in this century. A 4 degrees Celsius, big degrees, almost a 8 degree Fahrenheit global average warming is entirely possible in this century, and we're doing almost nothing about it in compared with what needs to be done. So I think that our politicians have got to be forced to act long before some of the deeper changes in the corporate, the nature of the corporation, and our consumerist habits, and other things that I talk about in the book are addressed, we have to act now on the climate threat. So that, in that sense, you know, I argue in the book that that reformist steps are still vitally important, but we need to complement them with, you know, really transformative changes.
We're down to about our next 9 minutes, and I want to get to a couple of other callers. But just to finish, I think the last caller also was asking at the tail end of his question about ethanol using food for fuel. I think in part what he's getting at is sometimes the solutions that we have in one area eclipse what we need to do in other areas. How do you feel about that specific issue?
Well, I think that corn-based ethanol is a big mistake. It's just a political thing now. Whether you're scared of it or love it, there's a lot of fossil fuel out there right now, and so I think corn-based ethanol is sort of the wrong direction. It's a political gift at this point, part of the feeding at the trough that Washington provides. But the real on the food issue, we ought to be dramatically reducing our consumption of meat in the country, and we ought to, both for health reasons and for environmental reasons, and we need to go to the great things going on in the country, and is in the food area with this, birth of the local food movement and food hubs and shorter supply chains in the food system. It's happening. It's one of the big great things happening at the local level. In our country. And back to one question that a caller earlier raised about revolution, in effect. Mm-hmm. He talked about shedding blood. I'm not there. I think we can do what we need to do, but I do think it's going to require, two things. That one is a rebirth of protests and demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience. We have got to go in that direction in a powerful way to demonstrate the seriousness of the problems and the seriousness of our intent to do something about them. And the other thing is we've got to be prepared for crises. Crises are going to happen. Environmental crises and climate-induced crises and economic crises. And we have got to be much better prepared for them, and not just in the immediate sense of cleanup or something of that type post-Sandy, but in the sense of using these failures of our system to dramatize the ongoing failure,
yeah.
To point to the things that we really need to do so that we won't have these recurring crises in the future. We're quite possibly going to have another financial crisis before long.
I'm going to need to interrupt again. Again, there's such richness in this book that there's so many different solutions and things that you do outline, and I want to encourage folks to read America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. Again, the author, James Gustav Speth. Gus is on the line with us. We've got three callers that we'd like to try to squeeze in by the end of the show. However, I'd ask if you could to try to be very succinct in your questions, and Gus, if you could also just give us maybe a briefer answer so we can make sure to squeeze this in here. Caller, your comment, your question, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm quoting Winona LaDuke, Mississippi Band Anishinaabe, two paragraphs. We recognize our relationship to the past and to our future because they are the same thing. This is a cyclic view of viewing things. We also believe in our community and in other places that you never take more than you need. You take what you need, give thanks, and you leave out the rest. Our view is very different from what has become the industrial of the North American worldview. The optimum person's linear view is the North American white man, who is the advanced man, who is civilized, who has the technology at his fingerprints and the economic growth in his pockets. Of course, the rest of us get left out of the process. Thanks.
All right, thank you. The Native American notion inherent in this is seven generations out, we've got to think. Is that part of the solution?
Well, I think we need a deep, if we're going to do any of these things and do them right, we're going to have a deep cultural transformation. New values come into the fore, and there's a lot to be learned from Winona LaDuke and the Native American worldview.
All right, caller, your comment or question for Gus?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, well, thank you. Mr. Quinlan, Mr. Speth, 15 minutes ago we talked about, we were promised that we were going to hear a bunch of hard-edged solutions to these problems, and basically what we got is the same sublimated kind of feel-good leftist arguments I've been hearing forever. Every solution that you bother to enumerate is based in electoral politics, which is clearly a dead end. The same banks, the same insurance companies, the same corporations own the two political parties.
Okay,
and
caller.
Third one or fourth one.
I'm going to ask you to cut to the punch.
What do we do about the rich?
So,
this is the problem.
Okay, that's
well,
why I wanted to get you to cut to the punch. Go ahead, Gus.
First, we need to have affirmative government policies that take us back to the level of equality, at least that we had in the mid-1970s. Where the rich, instead of having 24%, the top 1%, instead of having 24% of national income, had 9%. And we know how to get back there with the right kind of progressive taxation, with the right kinds of programs aimed at the poor, with an unemployment insurance program that's actually adequate, with a decent minimum wage, and other things. We can, reclaim this level of equality that we once had and go beyond it. Secondly, you mentioned the banks and the financial institutions. We need programs to basically rein in the big banks. They're more concentrated now than they were in 2008. And I think that one thing we definitely need to do is to break them up. And if we can't break them up, we need to have the public take a large share of the ownership of these institutions. Not a radical proposal. It was made by the very conservative Chicago School of Economists decades ago. We also need to build up public banking systems, co-op banks, local banks, get back to the kind of banking system that is boring and that helped us build the country after World War II. And I would say we need to go beyond all of that and also have basically 100% reserve requirement in the banks, 100% reserve requirements in the banks for demand deposits. Basically take the banks out of the business of making, producing money. Most of the money in the country is produced by bank debt. And when everybody paid off their debt, there wouldn't be much money left in circulation.
We're down to just
Basically, we could get the banks out of that business and do what Lincoln wanted to do, put the government in the business of spending money into the economy when it was needed.
We're down to about a minute's answer, but just want to emphasize to our last caller, to everyone, there's a richness within this book, America the Possible Manifesto for a New Economy, as well as other books that you've written, and we encourage people to investigate. If folks are feeling like we haven't said enough in terms of the solutions, that's because there just hasn't been time, but there are so many that you present here. Media is another area that I know you feel strongly about. You would quote John Nichols, Bob McChesney, two folks with Madison roots on this subject. What do we need to reform in terms of media?
Well, it's a great book. I think one of the recommendations, as I recall there, in John and Robert's book, is they point out that where in those places where journalism has public support, financial support, not just moral support, but where. That those countries rank at the highest level on the Economist Democracy Index. So it doesn't undermine democracy, or if you have, channels that could be independently managed and support journalism. We've had such a decimation of news offices and news desks and reporters and other things. And so we need to build up rebuild the journalism that we had, and we need to make it address the issues that it doesn't now address. I listened to Brian Williams.
Absolutely, and I apologize. With that note, I'm afraid we're out of time, but again, America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy, James Gustav Speth. It's a great book, and we encourage you to do this. And Gus, I hope you maybe come back with us again sometime to finish the conversation. So much to talk
about. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks very much. This has been A Public Affair. I'm John Quinlan. Have a great week. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.